I will open the House Committee on Human Services on February 23rd, 2011, and I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2464. We're going out of order, and I want to move back. 2464. Sorry. Yes, I know.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2464 expands to include individuals with disabilities who are under 19 years of age and who meet the disability criteria for supplemental security income, but whose family income or resources exceed the eligibility limits established by the Social Security Administration for supplementary security income payments to the definition of categorically needy person. It authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rule standards for premiums, copayments, or deductibles consistent with federal law for specified individuals subject to limits. It creates a Medicaid buy-in program for individuals with disabilities whose income exceeds 300% of the federal poverty guideline. And yeah.
Great. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Do we have anybody here to testify on this bill? Thank you. Catherine White.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. The council is a federally created council charged with policy analysis and system change in the areas of developmental disabilities. Excuse me. I've submitted three pieces of testimony. We are here in support of House Bill 2464. And this is a bill that has been presented to the legislature in the 2007-2009 legislative sessions previously. And the bill is an effort to address the issues of underinsurance as they relate to families who have children with very significant disabilities. These are families who may have health insurance, but whose health insurance does not cover the necessary therapies, durable medical equipment, and maybe access to specialized care that they need. Lacking this access, we have a hydraulic that often forces families to keep their income below federal SSI levels or keep their income at a point that they can access the Oregon Health Plan. So in other words, keep their families in poverty in order to pay for the medical care that their children need. Oregon was one of the last states in the nation to address the care needs of individuals who are living at home, young children with significant disabilities, and we're kind of at the bottom of states in terms of the support that we provide families. Since the original bill was proposed, Oregon has created a number of very limited Medicaid waivers that allow families to access Medicaid services. These are very limited waivers. The medically involved waiver was the last one that was passed. The criteria for getting into these programs is very, very high. In other words, kids have to have extreme disability to get into those programs. And the medically involved waiver, and I've described a little bit more about what those waivers are in my testimony, written testimony, does maintain a wait list. Oregon continues to score way above the national average with unmet health care needs of children with special health care needs. People identifying that their children have unmet health care needs, days of absence due to illness, and families that have cut or eliminated work because of their kids' health care needs. Oregon has done a great job of getting and expanding access to regular health care for, families who had children who had no access to health care. This is a group of families who have access to employment-provided health care, but for whom their health care does not meet the needs of their children with special needs. And I think, you know, if we look at this in the context of what is happening out there, we're seeing increasing numbers of families for whom their health care benefits have ratcheted down, their co-pays have increased. And when we're talking about significant surgeries 3 and 4 times a year, expensive durable medical equipment and other equipment, it puts even the most stable families into financial distress. I've provided you also with testimony from the OHSU program for children with special health care needs, and in that they have identified some of the things that they see at Oregon Health Sciences University in terms of families coming in to seek assistance whose health care does not cover the costs. I've also provided you with some stories. We were not able to get families down here today. It is a huge effort to, when you have a child like this, to come to Salem, and particularly when the weather is like it is projected to be. The word is out, and I had 10 phone calls on my answering machine this morning of families who had stories they wanted to share. These were stories that have been previously gathered, a few stories added to the stories that you may have seen. Several of these families have been able to access the waiver, the medically involved waiver that was created several years ago, and have reported their lives have turned totally right side up because they are able to get some access to help pay for their medical bills. One parent reported she's still paying off medical bills from years and years ago, but that she is getting assistance with a waiver. We would hope that you would seriously look at this issue and this problem. We have started some communication, some discussions. Is there any way to work with healthy kids? Is there any other option that we might be able to find for these families? They would maintain their private health insurance. This would be a backup wraparound for those costs that are extraordinary costs above and beyond normal health care that are directly related to children with significant disability. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Catherine. Any questions of Mrs. White? Yes, Representative.
Is this program envisioned to cover things like autism?
I think that would have to be defined. When the program was initially conceived, it was really focused on those very medically involved kids with durable medical needs, tubing, that kind of thing that is often not covered with standard medical insurance. But we've talked about that in terms of how this would all play within the autism community as well. And clearly many of the families who have kids with autism also experience significant medical costs.
Any other questions? Representative Widener.
This may not be directed to you, but have we even grabbed a fiscal on this yet to take a look at it? Because right now we're looking at our Oregon health plan and Medicaid being bankrupt by July. and now we're looking at adding a whole new classification of people, and we can't afford the system we have right now. And this is going to be expanding it dramatically. So I think we could be compounding the system that we have in place by adding in another class of people to it. So I don't know if you've looked into that at all.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have looked into some of this, and we're certainly aware of what is going on in terms of health care in Oregon. These families are also experiencing all the other retractions in the system. We're looking at eliminating family supports and other supports to families who have kids with disabilities. So we're really aware of what the dynamics are. I think the one thing that's important to remember is these families would maintain their private insurance. And so anything that private insurance doesn't cover, this would be the backup. But, yes, we're very aware of those issues.
Follow up. Because they already have insurance on them, and I see we're putting a cap on who could be on there with income level and everything. Do you see this compounding the problem that we're dealing with the Oregon Health Authority right now? Because we're looking at reducing reimbursement rates to doctors more, which means more people end up in emergency rooms because doctors won't take the programs or the people that are on the health plan right now. And to me, this looks like it's going to compound the problem and make our health care system worse rather than better.
Madam Chair and Representative, we haven't really run the numbers in terms of how many families that we have on the current system who are artificially impoverished either. So, in other words, they keep their income low because they have to maintain health care coverage for their children. So, you know, this is definitely a dynamic that we have to look at, how it would play. Who would these people be? Are there ways to limit the expenditures? There is an income cap. There is a buy-in requirement. So all of those numbers, we have not run those numbers at this point.
We will get a fiscal before we have a work session, of course. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gelser from House District 16 in Corvallis, and I'm pleased to bring you today House Bill 2464. This is the third session that we have talked about this bill, and pretty much every returning member, I think except for Representative Widener, has been a co-sponsor of this bill in the past. Let me tell you a little bit about what this bill is, what it does, and why it is so important, and why it actually will affect a cost savings, both in our system and the most important savings, which is keeping families together. And I think ultimately the most important thing we can do as policymakers is create family-friendly policies that don't break apart families. Our current system for children with complex disabilities is extraordinarily fragmented. It puts pressures on families that we can't begin to imagine, and it forces people into making unimaginable choices. Families cheerfully welcome home a new baby into their life that may bring with them complex medical needs that nobody has trained them in how to address. They love that child desperately, and they are working hard to figure out how to spiritually, emotionally, mentally, physically, and financially care for these children. Many of these children have health insurance. These are hardworking families who never would have imagined that they would have difficulty caring for their kids. But all of a sudden, they find out that this child is 8 years old and still requires diapers, which can cost hundreds of dollars a week, not covered by insurance. They might find out that this child does not have the capacity to swallow and therefore requires tube feeding and a special formula that comes through a bag not covered by insurance, hundreds of dollars a week. They may find that their 12-year-old is still not able to stand and be put into a bathtub. It requires someone to help them lift them into the tub. In-home care for a child if the family is not Medicaid eligible, not covered by insurance. So these are just a couple of the examples of the types of expenses that we are talking about covering. We're not talking about ear infections. We're not talking about surgeries. We're not talking about prescriptions. We are talking about those things that are above and beyond what most of us could imagine that become the critical question about whether or not a child can continue to live and grow up in their family home. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about how I became involved in this issue and why this opportunity is a great one for us to save families and to save money for the state of Oregon. In 2004, I went to work for the Oregon Department of Human Services. And when I worked there, I was the Children with Disabilities and Family Support Coordinator. And one of the first questions that I had that I was curious about was, where are these kids? Where are kids with disabilities in the state of Oregon? And I started out to try to track them down. And I was surprised to learn that we had hundreds of Oregon kids who were voluntarily placed in foster care. They were not in foster care because they were abused and neglected. They were not in foster care because their parents could not care safely for them. They were in foster care because their families could not access services and supports to allow them to continue to care for them at home. In addition to that, we had 80 children that were growing up in nursing homes. In these nursing homes, we were paying approximately $162 per day to support these kids. So I became curious, what is it that would cause these kids, what would cause a parent to make that choice to release their kids? I wanted data. Those of you that know me know I like data. So I set out as an employee of the Department of Human Services and did file reviews on all of these kids. And I created a matrix, and I tried to figure out what could we see in common amongst all of these kids in the months leading up to that choice to place them out of the home. There were a whole variety of things that came up, but the biggest one was the family was asking for support, little tiny things, little things that could help them. And they could not access them. Our system did not provide those services, so they made the much more expensive choice of placing their kids into care. One example, there was a child at a large nursing home in the Portland area that serves children. That family, the child was 12. They asked for a couple of hours of in-home support to help with lifting and bathing of this child. They were put on a waiting list, were not able to access those services. The mother blew out her knees. The father blew out his back. They both needed surgery. Nobody could care for the child, so she was placed in a nursing home, and both of the parents were on disability because they could no longer work. Either providing a couple of hours of in-home support or several $100 lift could have prevented all of that from happening. They didn't want that child to leave their home. There was another child that I met. This was also a nursing home child where the parents had asked for, I think it was 10 hours of respite care per week on a waiting list for our family support program, far away from being able to do that. That child couldn't get the respite care. That child went into a nursing home. When I found that child in a nursing home in 2004, she was in a tiny little room with padded walls and a mattress on the floor with a sheet thrown over the top and no toys, and the door was covered by a plexiglass shield, and there was a chain with a lock on it. This was 2004, and that girl had been in that room since 1998. She had autism. Her single mother wanted a few hours of respite in order to keep her in the home. Fortunately, in 2007, we passed the companion bill to this, which expanded our medically involved waiver, and that was targeted at kids in nursing homes. That child transitioned out of the nursing home and is living in a community, actually was reunited with her family, which was a pretty exciting thing, and all of you can be very proud of working hard to make that happen for them and some other kids. So some kids go out of home. They leave the home because they don't have these resources. Other families can't imagine letting go of their children, and they try to figure out how can they work within the system to keep these kids at home. And the choices that they make are also unthinkable. Perhaps they have three kids at home, one with a severe disability, in order to access Medicaid eligibility for that child in order to get a couple of hours respite, someone to come in and help them lift the child, that tube, the food that goes through that tube. They artificially impoverish themselves. Every year when they do their annual reviews with their employer, and my husband supervised one of these people, they have to go and calculate how much of their raise they have to turn back so that they can live and continue working but remain just below the poverty level so that that child can access Medicaid. Colleagues, this is a stupid public policy, because when they do that, not only is that child eligible for Medicaid, you're forcing that entire family onto the Oregon Health Plan. You're forcing that entire family into needing social net costs. It would be far less costly to provide these inexpensive services that would allow these children to remain at home. Other families divorce. There's no problems in the marriage, but the only way that they can get that down is that the parents divorce, they separate, and you've taken a parent away from that child, and you've disrupted that entire family. Finally, you have the impact on the other siblings in that family. When a family is artificially impoverishing themselves, keeping themselves below that Medicaid level so that they can keep that child at home, those other kids are not playing sports, they are not accessing music, they can't go to college. There are all of these opportunities that are closed off to them. One of the craziest things about having a child with a disability, I'm sure that when most of you had children, you went and you opened up your savings account because you wanted to save for them for the future. When you give birth to a child with a disability, the advice that you get from everyone is, you cannot afford to save for this child because it's either all or nothing. This child can have no assets, your family can have no assets, and you're not going to be able to make enough to be able to pay for all the needs of this child. So impoverish yourself so that your child can be cared for, and the most important thing to you, keeping your child at home, is something that can happen. I would close with one more story and then get into the specifics of what this legislation does. But in 2007, when we first brought this bill out and the other bill, a constituent of mine came. And in the past, for the last two sessions, we've had hearing rooms filled with families that have come. And this was scheduled rather quickly. And as you can imagine, for these families, it takes a lot of planning to be able to get the respite in place, to be able to get kids here, to be able to come out and engage in these conversations. These are very overwhelmed families. But two of my constituents came. One actually came, her daughter had died the week before the hearing, and this issue was so important to her that she came to this hearing the week after her daughter's funeral. And she described how her son, who I believe was about 10 years old at the time, and this family was in that place of having artificially impoverished themselves, and he would listen to his family having these conversations, and he drew a picture of what it looked like. He said, it's like we have these two cliffs, and we have to figure out how to get from one side to the other. And in this gap in the middle, if we fall into it, I lose my sister. You have to figure out how to get from one side to the other with your paycheck and to be able to keep this child at home. That was so profound to that family that this small child could see that dynamic, that they came the week after their child died in order to testify to this bill. And the other thing she said was, whether your child dies or doesn't die, the silence in your home when a child is missing, even when that child is nonverbal, is earth-shattering. Just that silence of that person, that child, that family member no longer being there is earth-shaking. The other constituent that came actually spoke at our press conference in 2007. She was a family. She's a single mother, two kids, one with a disability, one not. She worked at a university. Every year she worked to keep her salary low enough to be able to maintain SSI eligibility for her daughter. This child had autism and also had significant seizure activity, and she needed some in-home support and some respite. She was starting to have trouble because she was seeing the lack of opportunities that her son was having, and she was trying to figure out, how do I balance the need between these two children? And she was wrestling with her own sense of, I'm not comfortable using the public services that I need to use, and this would really help me. If I could pay a premium to buy into Medicaid as a supplement to my private insurance, I could keep this child at home. I could access these things. She was very, very passionate, very eloquent. A couple of you were there in this press conference and listened to her. A year and a half after that, I got an email from this mother that said, it pains me to write you this letter, but today I took my daughter and dropped her off at her new foster care home. I could no longer do this and take care of my son. And that has been several years ago. That young woman is still in foster care. And as you can imagine, that has been devastating to her mother. It has been devastating to her brother. And it has been devastating to her. And in that family, again, what was needed was a couple of hours of respite and some in-home support. Talked about the human consequences. The fiscal consequences for the state is, we will be supporting that child in foster care for the entire rest of her life. there's a way to fix this. And the problem, if we don't fix it, is going to get worse. If you look at the fiscal crisis that we are in and what is happening to our budgets within seniors and people with disabilities, our programs are being devastated. The place where families can get access to in-home support and respite right now is in the Family Support Program. This is a general fund-only program. It's a program, if you have questions about it, feel free to talk to me about it. I was responsible for that program when I worked at DHS. The waiting list for it is over 1,000 kids long. That is how much people need these services, and they're modest services that people get, and the program is scheduled for complete elimination at the end of this biennium. The impact of that complete elimination will be kids going into foster care. Now, what we can do with the Family Opportunity Act, or House Bill 2464, is allow some of those very same families, even though they are not currently Medicaid eligible, to buy into Medicaid as a supplement to their private insurance. This means that they will be required to maintain their insurance, but by paying a premium, they can get some of those benefits like in-home care, the diapers, the special diet formulas. They can access those through Medicaid, and they won't have to impoverish themselves, and they will stay on their private insurance, as will everybody else in their family. They can continue to pull down the wages that they've worked hard to be able to pull down in their profession. And the other thing that we get in doing that is where our family support program right now is general fund only, this will bring a Medicaid match. So we will have federal dollars that will come in and help us to pay for this. This was bipartisan legislation at the federal level because people on both sides of the aisle recognized that the extraordinary costs that are faced by families raising exceptional children, including kids with autism, are enough that there does need to be a little extra help. It is my hope, and I plan to work with DHS to figure out how we can adjust this, make it work, make it compliant with our Oregon Healthy Kids program to figure out how we can do it in the most cost-effective way possible. But I can tell you, even if there is a fiscal on this bill, I hope that you will move this bill onto the Ways and Means Committee so they can have this policy option and they can have this policy vehicle to talk about how they are going to balance the needs in that SPD population and how we are going to work to safely reduce the number of kids in foster care and how we can make sure that these budget reductions we are making are not going to lead us to have an influx of new kids coming into foster care, not because they're abused or neglected, but because their families need just a tiny bit of help. And I would end with this one piece, and this is old. This is out of a report that I wrote when I worked for SPD. But as I was studying this, I went to a training. And it was a training about people that are going through the crisis system. You go into the crisis system when all of a sudden your family can't care for you anymore. Kids that go into, and this was from a consultant that came and spoke, kids that go into crisis in childhood remain there in adulthood. Part of the problem is that the lack of family support devastates the best and most important resource a person with a disability has, their very own family. When we don't support families until they are in crisis, and the primary resource that we offer is separation from that family, we remove people from those who know and love them best. This lack of stability is not what is needed to move from crisis to success. Colleagues, I hope you will give this bill due consideration. Our policy does not have to be this way. You can move this on to Ways and Means and help keep these families together. I think it's one of the most important things we can do this session. Clearly, I'm very passionate about it. Happy to answer any questions here or offline and look forward to working with DHS to find the most cost-effective way to help these children and their families. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. As I recall, these bills went twice to Ways and Means, right? And that's where we've hit the snag.
Madam Chair, correct. Last session, this made it further down the line. I believe it was in the discussions in 2116, and we weren't able to finish massaging it. I believe that we are closer this time, and as a policy, getting it to that area is important, even more so this time because of the slated elimination of the Family Support Program, which takes any supports for these families off the table until they're in crisis and moving out of the home.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming today. Shift for a minute from how very well you did articulate the need of these families and just to the part about the budget. Mm-hmm. This is not a, you know, Ways and Means sub, we know that. But because of your experience at the department, Tell me a little bit more about when you say the budget cuts we're facing. Are we talking about the governor's recommended budget, a budget that has, the governor's recommended budget has more relevance in this session than any session I've had for lots of reasons, but I think partly because we're starting to work pretty well with this governor. Is that what you're talking about in terms of cuts? And the reason I say that is nobody comes into our offices asking to cut their budgets. But you give a very compelling case for don't, I'm going to mix up my metaphors here, don't cut your off your nose to spite your face. I mean, I feel this way about OPI. It seems like this comes into that category. In terms of savings, what little it would take under the presentation you made to not only help a family, but save tons of costs down the line. Are we looking at the governor's budget? And what is the department going to say about this program?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, first of all, I have an idea of what the department is going to say, but I would let them say that. And
right.
I also want to clarify, I'm sharing my observations, and certainly we all learn things in the places we work, and that represents my opinion only and no one else's. And I'm sure the department is here to speak in a moment. When I'm talking about the budget reductions, I'm looking at two things. The governor's recommended budget, which does zero out the family support program, and I'm also looking at the very real fact that that family support program is on life support right now. When we vote on the rebalance bills later this week or next week, we are voting to extend that program through the end of the year. That program has taken substantial reductions over the last several years, as have all programs in our developmental disability program. RDD programs get very overshadowed by many other programs that are out there, and especially with concentrating child welfare and SPD into one agency, which is DHS, they are going to be disproportionately impacted by the reductions that we need to make. Make no mistake, SPD services and CAF services, those are not luxury services. Those are not prevention-based services. Those are services of people who are in the very, very most needy and vulnerable position. So I think it's also coming from a place of realism, of knowing that the challenges in that agency are really great. I would hate to see that family support program eliminated. I think it is one of those things that needs to be the top priority there, because if we can keep people at home, it is more cost-effective. It is more cost-effective to support a child in their family home with a little bit of extra support when their family is doing 90% of it than to support the entire family in a public program and be committing to that child in public care for the entire rest of their duration. However, this is a way, if we do end up eliminating that family support program, that we can more cost effectively and with federal help get some of those same services to some of those same kids. We're still going to lose kids. Eliminating family support is going to hurt kids that don't fall under this limit, and that is the thing. Some of these kids are so complex, you might look at the income of that family on a piece of paper and say, hey, this family's making $70,000 a year, $80,000 a year. What's the problem? But when you're out-of-pocket costs for the feeding and maintenance of that child are above $3,000 and your other person can't work outside the home because you're having to provide 24-hour care for this individual and you have your own medical costs for all the lifting, all of a sudden that income doesn't go nearly as far as you would expect.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yes, Representative Thompson.
This is a little off the subject and picking up on what your esteemed co-chair just said. Is it possible that we might hold a hearing, information hearing with DHS and talk about their intentions? We're looking at the Oregon Health Authority, what they're going to be doing in their package. We're looking at the Essential Benefits Plan that is tied to the federal program. We're looking at OPI. We're looking at this. How do all these things come together? Or is there any intention to bring all of them together? I understand they're zeroed out in the governor's budget, but do they come back in someplace else? Is there an intention to deal with this? And I, too, am concerned that our disability-oriented projects, we've been slicing those for years and years, and I don't see the problem going away, just the funding.
I think
if we could find a way to focus and just ask that question. What is your intention? I certainly don't know.
I think that is an excellent suggestion.
Looks like
and I'll work with
Representative Malik must know the answer.
Well, I will work with my co-chair to see if we can come up with an informational hearing.
Yeah.
Asking those questions, that would be excellent. Representative Greenlick.
Yeah, I just wanted to make two comments, Madam Chair. First, with regard to what Representative Thompson just said, I mean, we are hearing these in the Ways and Means Subcommittee now, and I don't think the agency knows what to do. I mean, the budget shortfalls they're facing when you look at 15, 20, 25% cuts are just devastating, and this isn't a matter. I mean, there's going to be blood all over the floor given the budget situation, and I think we just need to face it. But what we need to be doing is to maximizing the programs that do the most good. And this model, which moves from a program that's pure general fund, as Representative said, to a program that will be 60% or 65% funded by federal funds is something to be looking at while we're trying to look at this just absolute terrible funding situation. I mean, it's just devastating to look at those. And I think both of the policy committees, this committee and the health committee, ought to be trying to provide feedback to the Ways and Means Committee. I mean, that's the only way they're going to get the kind of policy discussions that need to happen. They should not be happening there. They should be happening here. So, I would certainly support the notion of providing policy input to the Ways and Means Subcommittee about our priorities. And the agency's catatonic. I mean, to a certain extent, they're doing their job, but they're just devastated because they know these programs are going to be hurt very badly.
Yes. Representative Parrish.
Hold on a second. Were you in front of me? You had your hand up, too.
Go ahead. Okay. I'll wait till the end. I'd like to close.
Help me out here. Do you have any idea of, you mentioned that families go into foster care on purpose. Do you have a sense if something like this were in place, how many of those kids we could actually roll back out to their families? Or is that even possible at this point?
Madam Chair, Representative Parrish, I do believe that it is possible to reunite some families. Unfortunately, just in the study that I've done on this issue over the last several years and looking at other states, your biggest impact is the prevention of kids that are moving out. I mean, once that decision has been made and the families, I mean, as you can imagine, that is an emotionally and psychologically devastating decision to make and one that's becomes complicated to roll back from. But I think that where your real savings is in that exodus of kids moving out. And one more thing, if I may, tagging on to Representative Greenlick, I would agree that the department has a very difficult challenge ahead of them in terms of figuring out how to take care of all of the people that they are serving with the minimal resources that we are offering to them. But the tremendous resource that we have in that agency, and I don't say this often enough, but would like the chance to do so, we are so lucky to have very smart, value-driven leaders in the Department of Human Services, in seniors and people with disabilities, who are creative and focused on community-based supports and on keeping families together. I think that we are unique in this state for the type of values that drive people like James Taves and Mary Lee Fay, who come here in front of you frequently, who are constantly racking their brains. On this issue, I have tremendous gratitude to the folks at DMAP, who have been deep into the guts of this bill for a long time, trying to help us figure out a way to make it affordable. And I am so grateful to the people at DHS, who I know are deeply committed to these kids and their families and all the populations that they serve.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of overall, because you have a lot of knowledge from working in DHS and everything, but I think as a committee, as we're facing some of these situations, and the co-chairs for you guys to think about is looking at where our overlap is in a lot of these systems through what the state does, what the county does, and starting to put some of that together where we can maximize what we're doing. So we may be making cuts. They might lose a little bit, but they're still getting some support. That way, when we're eliminating some of these programs, we eliminate the right ones because we know there's help coming from the county level or some other place. So I don't know if there's any way where we could get a flow chart showing that or if we have anything designed, but I think that would be very helpful to us as a committee and to our Ways and Means Committee as well. So.
And I think if we have an informational hearing, we could request that kind of information also. It's a good idea.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
To Representative Widener's point, the family support program that we talked about, the state flows those monies down to the counties. The counties will stop offering these programs because that funding comes from the state. This is a shared service where the counties are in most counties, are not paying for these services. It is administered by the county, paid for by the state.
So we'll get that information clarified. Thank you. We have Judy Moore-Peterson who would... Thank you. Any other questions before you go? And then we have another bill coming up.
I'll
if
stay.
You could stay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judy Moore-Davis. Judy, we're going to ask you... No, come on up. But, yeah, we're sort of running out of time, so...
Hi. Good morning. I was running over here, so I... apologize, I'm still a little out of breath.
Would you like some water?
Making it here. No, I'm good. Thank you. For the record, my name is Judy Moore-Peterson. I'm the administrator for the medical assistance programs with the Oregon Health Authority. And you'll be receiving the written testimony here. Primarily what I'd like to do today is simply outline what the bill does and what the impact would be on the department, and then if we have time, we can go into a little bit about some suggestions that we might have, or we can also just express the fact that we are quite willing and happy to continue to work with Representative Gelser on this particular bill. The bill allows families who have significant disabilities, as you've already heard, to access the Oregon Health Plan. These are families that whose incomes are actually too high to be eligible for OHP now, in some cases, for the full Oregon Health Plan Medicaid benefit. And it has several also components that actually help limit the costs for the families or to help them ensure eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. So the families either would have no premiums or they would pay on a sliding scale, a premium based on their incomes. Their assets and resources would not count in determining the child's eligibility. And their out-of-pocket costs would be limited to a maximum of 5% of the family's income. In addition, and this is actually a key point here, is that the authority, we would not have a period of uninsurance. We could actually also cover the children if they had other forms of insurance before they would become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. It would add children who are under the age of 19 who meet the Supplemental Security Income Disability or Chronic Illness criteria. And in the testimony, you'll see that that is about $67,000 for a family of four. So currently, children, regardless of their health or disability status, are eligible for OHP plus benefits. That's a full comprehensive package of medical, dental, mental health, and other kind of services. And they are eligible up to 200% of the federal poverty or less. There are some cost-sharing limits that the bill would allow us to implement. We could impose limited co-payments or deductibles for families with incomes above 250% of the federal poverty level. And then families with incomes through 300% of the federal poverty level who have access to employer-sponsored insurance, whose employer contributes more than 50%, we would then have them purchase their insurance through that employer and then provide a wraparound. And then the authority would, we would pay 100% of the family share of premiums for families with incomes who are below 250% of the federal poverty or below. For those families who are above 300% of the federal poverty level, we would establish a program that would allow families to purchase the OHP benefit package at a premium that is for our standard child level premium that we pay to our Medicaid managed care plans today. Of note, that is not what we pay to our Medicaid managed care plans for people with disabilities. So it is less than that. We do have some suggestions, as I mentioned before. In the interest of time, I won't necessarily go through those today, but we would suggest making some changes so that we could maximize the federal match dollars, as well as some other tweaks to the bill that would make it more administratively feasible for us to administer.
Thank you so much. Any quick questions here? Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judy, you mentioned businesses, and the business owner in me just went, wait, what am I going to be committing to now? I always try to provide good coverage for my employees, but as I read quickly through this section, it doesn't look like any increased burden upon businesses, large or small. Is that a correct reading?
That co-chair error. Our co-chair, yes. Co-chair and Representative Harker, indeed, it would not require any additional burden on businesses or employers.
Thank you.
I think this committee is very interested in this issue, and thank you so much for being willing to work with Representative Gelser to see what we can do. I think most of us are loath to send anything onto Ways and Means for obvious reasons, but this seems like one of those issues that we might want to be more involved in. It seems like some ways we can be penny wise and pound foolish, and it might be one of those situations. So we'll look forward to hearing more from all of you. And for now, we will be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2413. And we will not be hearing 2398 today. I hope nobody is here for that bill. And Representative Gelser, we're going to bring you up for a work session on House Bill 2460. And go ahead and read the summary.
Excuse me, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. We sent out yesterday, we also put at the dais, there has been a Dash 4 amendment to House Bill 2460. We heard this bill a couple of times on the 7th of February and on the 21st of February. The Dash 4 was drafted to address concerns that were raised at our 21st hearing when we were talking about the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 4 now deletes the reference to the Oregon Revised Statute 124.050, which referenced the exemption of alcohol and drug treatment providers from the requirement to report elder abuse and from criminal records check requirements. Outside of that proviso, it's the same as the Dash 1 amendment that you had before you on that day.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You may remember this discussion from Monday. It was very complicated.
Sorry. Tell me again who you are.
Oh. Let's see.
Looks familiar.
I am Sarah Gelser, State Representative from Corvallis and Philomath, and two people in Linn County. never want to forget my two constituents from Linn County. So what this amendment does, you'll remember we had a discussion both about the bill summary and about the question of abuse reporting requirements. What we have done is completely removed any reference, any change whatsoever to any population that might ever be reported for abuse. So that whole question about A, B, C, it's just all gone. We've taken it all out. What remains is the important part of this bill, which is exempting drug and alcohol providers from some provisions that are important in other DHS populations. I forwarded on to the committee administrator and the co-chairs a memo that Lori Freeman in Legislative Council nicely drafted that ensured and assured us that the summary on the top of the bill will be amended before it's sent to the floor, so it will not say all the things you don't like. And in terms of others who were interested in that other piece of the bill that we had pulled out, I had advised them that because the underlying policy issue here is more important, if people are interested in pursuing that, that would be better done through a different bill vehicle where you can all have a robust conversation about who and who should not be reporting what to whom.
Great, Representative. Any questions of Representative Gelson? All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And this is not a public hearing, so it's not opened to other testimony unless somebody feels a burning need. Nobody seems to feel a burning need. So, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments that are dated 2/21/11 to this bill, 2460.
Chair Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments. Dated 2/21/11. Is there any to House Bill 2460? Any discussion? Any objection? So done. The motion passes. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I think the next thing we should do is move on to the bill itself, and that's why I move that House Bill 2460, as recently amended, to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 2460 as amended to the floor with a recommendation to be adopted. Due pass recommendation. Yeah. Any discussion? We need a better script. We both use scripts.
You've got one down there.
Okay. Yes, Representative.
Madam Chair, I would be honored to vote for this bill now, as long as it shows up on the floor with the right one. Otherwise, I might have to have a little speech. So,
right.
If it doesn't have everything squared away when it hits the floor, so
great. Glad to hear that, Representative. Any other discussion, Mr. Co-Chair?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just two quick questions. I'll do anything to avoid a speech by Representative White. And I'd like to point out that the fact that this bill went much smoother today than it did when I happened to be chairing Monday has nothing to do with who's chairing. Well, maybe it does.
Can we vote on that?
I'm done.
All right. All right. Any other discussion? Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Arthur.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
And Chair Gilliam?
Aye.
Chair
Clement? Aye. Having received the required majority, this bill passes. And Representative Gelser, I bet you'd like to carry this. Great. All right. With that, I will close the work session, House Bill 2460. I'll go back to my agenda. So we will open up a work session on House Bill 2057. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we received some additional testimony after the hearing that we held on February 21st to address some of the concerns that were raised during that hearing. I forwarded that testimony onto each member. So in summary, House Bill 2057 expanded the definition of person with a disability for individuals who are served by the Department of Human Services.
Great.
So we're ready for a work session.
Great. And we got some materials.
We received some materials from James Taves, the Assistant Director from Senior and Persons with Disabilities. Part of the discussion was the clarification with regard to the term person and definition of person with a disability, and he provided a written response relative to those concerns, as well as a fact sheet regarding medically involved and medically fragile children in the development of disabilities in children and adults and families, foster care, as well as a geographical chart of the
of those services. And that was, the last two documents were in reference to questions raised by Representative Frederick wanting some numbers relative to those issues.
Everybody got those? Anybody got a problem? Any questions? Concerns? All right. Are we ready for a motion? Yes.
Quick. I'm not seeing anything on the fiscal impact, or they haven't updated it online. So I don't know if we got a printed one here.
Representative Widener, the fiscal impact, there was a fiscal statement issued. It was provided on the 21st, and there was a minimal expenditure impact. I'm happy to.
I trust you.
It was dated February 18th, the one that I have.
It's in the one.
Yeah. And it says it will have a net cost savings, mm-hmm. and therefore sending it to Ways and Means is not necessary. Do you want a copy of that, Representative?
That is fine.
Great.
Trust me. I have to stay half paper and half online.
I know.
My computer is not updated all the time.
It was easier when it was all paper, frankly.
Yes, I am.
Any other questions or concerns? All right. Representative.
All right. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Chair Gilliam moves House Bill 2057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Greenman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick.
Aye.
Chair Gilliam.
Aye.
Chair Coleman.
Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 2057 passes. Who hasn't carried a bill yet in this meeting? Oh, come on, you guys.
I've got one.
From this committee?
I've got one pending.
Okay. Great. All right. Thank you for volunteering, Representative Lou Frederick. Thank you. All right. Now we're moving on. Where are we? We've done all of our work session, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now we can have a hearing on 2314, correct? Okay, I open up a public hearing on House Bill 2314. Jennifer.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2314 exempts school social workers from licensing requirements of clinical social workers. You also have a dash one amendment, which replaced the original measure. In addition, I want to note that this is Representative Greenlich's bill, and I think he would like to offer some testimony on that. There is an additional amendment that's in the process of being drafted by Legislative Council as well, which will be addressed in testimony, but we don't have that back from them yet.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mitch Green, State Representative, House District 33, Northwest Portland, west to North Plains, and I'm really happy to introduce this bill. We've been working with the teachers, Representative Comp and I, with the Teachers Standards and Practice Commission for some time to create a category of school social worker. As the problems of dealing with classrooms become more and more complex, with the autism tsunami that's facing us and other kinds of difficulties, it's been very clear to some of us that we need to be training social workers to be working in the schools. And over the past two sessions, we've worked with them and with the universities in the state, and the universities are now prepared to train master-level social workers specifically to work in the schools. And the Teachers Standards and Practice Commission is now agreed to license them as school social workers, analogously to the way school psychologists and speech and language pathologists are licensed to work in the school separately from their professional licensure. That's been working very well. It's had a rocky journey, but it's going very well. And now the Teachers Practice and Standards Commissions have suggested that we introduce this bill, which does one thing, or at least until we hear whatever the dash twos are. And the one thing it does is exempt Teacher Standards and Practice Commission licensed school social workers from the requirements of the Clinical Social Work Act, which has a special set of requirements, although they might possibly go that way too with other specific training. So it's again analogous to the exemptions in the Psychology Practice Act and I think in the Speech and Language Pathology Act to exempt these folks from that further certification. And that's basically all the bill does. The dash one amendment is simply to clarify this at the request of the social work group, simply to make it more clear. It doesn't change it substantively at all.
Great. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill to our committee.
Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Greenwood? Thank you very much. We also have Mara Roche, who would like to speak, and Martin Pidioni. Am I pronouncing that anywhere close?
Almost. We've got dash ones. Could you have one?
Good morning, Chair Tobey and Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. Maura Roach, representing NASW Oregon. Representative Greenlake basically just delivered my testimony for me, and since I'm losing my voice, I think in the interest of time, I will go ahead and just turn it over to Martin Pignoni from the board and be available here for questions should any arise. Thank you.
Thank you, Maura. Sounds like you've got a bit of a cold.
Good morning, Co-Chair Representative Tomei, Co-Chair Representative Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Pitioni. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Licensed Social Workers, and I just briefly like to get on the record. You have written testimony from me in support of House Bill 2314 for both the dash one amendments as well as the dash two amendments to come. I want to echo the statements of Representative Greenlake that this is a very simple fix in the dash ones. They do not change the substantive nature of what the original bill does. I'd like to just briefly put on the record that as a state agency, we do have permission from the governor's office to testify in favor of the dash ones as well as the dash twos to come, so that's part of the record and the various and the various advisors in the governor's office have been consulted. So I'm here with permission. One piece that I just want to very briefly also put on the record is, in essence, the issue addressed here is one that relates to title protection. You may recall that this committee in the 2009 session really did a phenomenal job helping us craft the final version of Senate Bill 177 in the 2009 session, which really broadly expanded the regulatory scope of the board, including adding two new license types as well as adding very broad title protections for the term social worker. And basically what the dash ones do is they permit limited access to that social worker title protection for those that are licensed through TSPC as social workers by allowing them to use the title school social worker without having to go through licensure from the Board of Licensed Social Workers. That's really the core objective that's going on here. And then with your permission, I'd like to very briefly preview the dash two amendments that are also coming before you that are not conflict amendments. They're on a separate small issue where I'm basically
where the Dash 2 amendments basically address a very small technical fix also related to that very same bill that I just mentioned, Senate Bill 177, 2009. And this one is basically a small problem that cropped up in ORS 675-530, which basically requires, it basically unnecessarily required a non-clinical master's level license as part of the clinical licensure program. That was simply an error that was written into one sentence in an overall large bill. We missed it. We didn't catch it. This will fix it, and it's basically an amendment that basically streamlines things for both the applicants and the board and maintains a very clean separation between the clinical programs that the board has and the non-clinical programs. The effect of the Dash 2s simply is to make sure that, as it was before 177, we have a clinical preparatory program through the certification of Clinical Social Work Associate, which is the preparatory program for the licensed clinical social worker, and that the licensed master social worker, which is a non-clinical license that this committee helped us create, has nothing to do with that clinical track. And it basically, what the Dash 2s do, it moves us back to the statutory language we had before in that specific section of the statute. It basically just reverts back to the old text for that section. It's a very simple technical fix, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Any quick questions? Go ahead. Representative Boone is here to testify on two other bills that we have, and I just want to make sure we've got time for her, but go ahead.
This is very quick, and it might be to Representative Greenlick, but after hearing this, I think this isn't as easy as I thought, and I might need a counselor. I'm just not sure what type of counselor I will need to figure this out.
A counselor or a therapist?
I can't help you, but I can't comment on the Dash 2s, and I'm perfectly happy to have the Dash 2s tag along unless they cause some opposition to the bill itself, and if they do, I'll be happy to throw it out of the boat. It also points out how careful you need to be about a relating clause. This one relating to social workers leaves lots of room for mischief.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
If I may just say for the record, NASW Oregon also supports the Dash 2 amendment.
That's good to hear. Thank you. All right, with that, we'll close the public hearing on, what are we doing? 2314. Thank you. And we're going to open up the hearing on HJM 12 and HJM 13. And Representative Boone, we're glad you were here today. Thank you for staying.
Thank you for having me. And for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I understand you've opened up both of these hearings, and I'm here to testify on both of them.
Great.
Do you want this just together?
You know, I haven't had Jennifer do the summary. Let me do that first.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was out of order here.
HJM 12 urges the resumption of the White House Conference on Children and Youth. There is a Dash 1 amendment that will be forthcoming, which basically just removes the references to congressional bill numbers, which are out of date. So that's all that will do on that amendment. On HJM 13, it urges Congress to pass the Social Work Reinvestment Act, and there is a Dash 1 amendment that you've received, and it's the same fix. It just removes the reference to the congressional bill numbers. They're out of date on that as well.
Okay, thank you. All right, Representative.
And I will be brief, but I did want to come down here and testify in favor of both of these House Joint Memorials. And I'll start with House Joint Memorial 12, and I see three of the committee members are co-sponsors of it also, so this is your bill, too. And many of you may know that I came out of the child abuse prevention field after I got my degree in psychology and spent a very short period of time in treatment because I was treating basically bad boys. And I decided that it would be a better use of my time and mental health to work on the other end of things. And I'm still doing that. I see, if you read through all the whereas, that's your reasons for doing this bill or this memorial. And one of the things in the very end of it, points out that this conference, the White House Conference on Children and Youth, has been happening since 1909. I didn't start quite that soon, but I started 70 years later. And the state used to have a Governor's Commission on Youth, and I got into this sector with Jean Babson, Jean McCall Babson, the ex-governor, former governor's sister, and worked with her closely on that, and we assumed that we would be having this conference, but apparently it has not happened since then, so since 1970. So I urge you to pass this memorial on to Congress, and it will help us reset the priorities for our children and at the White House level, which is the highest government level in this country. And I think it just sends a message that this should be a priority, because I think one of the most stunning numbers in it is on the second page, and we're still in the five-digit numbers of abuse and neglect, and I would love to see people in this field basically out legislated and worked out of their jobs, because that would mean that we don't have any children who are abused and neglected and suffering. So please support this. And now I will just briefly mention my support for House Joint Memorial 13, which urges Congress to pass the Social Work Reinvestment Act. And I support it. You can read all the whereases also. And my support comes in from also my position on the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. We're going to be inundated with a tsunami of returning vets from our wars, and we're going to need more and more social workers. And so this puts it again at the highest level, and it asks our Congress to reinvest in helping retain social workers and recruit more, because we're going to need them. So please consider both of these memorials favorably, and let's send our congressional delegation a good message from Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boone, for staying with us and presenting
Thank you.
Us today. You're welcome. We have several people who are wanting to testify on these. Jessica Ritter, Elaine, begins with a C and then a P, Sam Jones, Pamela Butte, and that's it. I think, that would be four. Can we pull up another chair?
Sure.
Matt, can we pull up the fourth chair there? Thank you for coming, Day, and just start talking.
Sure.
Introduce yourselves, please.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm very grateful to be able to be here today to talk to you about this House Joint Memorial 12. Chairs Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Ritter, and I'm an assistant professor at Pacific University in Forest Grove. I'm also a member of the National Association of Social Workers, and when I was a practicing social worker, I pretty much dedicated my career to working in the field of child welfare, and my very first social work job was working in child protection in another state. So we're here to talk to you. A theme you'll probably hear today is this White House Conference on Children has not happened in many, many years. So the first one was in 1909 under President Theodore Roosevelt. And it happened every 10 years, and really wonderful outcomes resulted from that. And it stopped in 1970. So it's been 40 years since people have been brought together, you know, people in child welfare who have a lot of experience and expertise to talk about the state of children, to talk about the state of child welfare systems, which you all know usually have a lot of challenges in doing the important job that they do. Down at the bottom of my testimony, I talk about some of the outcomes of these conferences, and organizations were born out of them, the Child Welfare League of America, the creation of the American Pediatric Society. There were conferences that focused on child welfare and the institutionalization of children. So I know that some people tend to be skeptical sometimes about this kind of a, you know, method in terms of, you know, is it worth the time and resources? And I would argue that it certainly is. So what I tried to do for you in my testimony is just to break down the highlights of the federal bill and kind of how it works. And really, it's focused on improving outcomes for children in the child welfare system, preventing child abuse and neglect, increasing permanency for children that are served in the child welfare system, reducing the number of children in foster care, and especially reducing the number of children who age out of foster care each year. And the Secretary of Health and Human Services is kind of the overseer of making sure the conference, you know, goes as planned and overseeing that whole process. There's a policy committee that gets selected of 17 members, and they are selected from by their, you know, experience in the child welfare field. As a result, there's a period of time where these the people that would be involved are they select them purposely for their experience, but also geographic region to make sure that we're kind of having a really good representation of perspectives on where we are as a country in terms of serving children and families in the child welfare systems. And then there would be a final report that would go to all the chief executives of the states. It would go to the president. It would go to the U.S. Congress. And this final report would basically have a lot of recommendations, or really kind of a coherent policy of what we need to have happen in this country to try to move us forward, in terms of looking at the latest research in the field in child welfare and kind of trying to better outcomes for children and youth. And one thing I will say, just to kind of end here today, my class, I teach a class at Pacific, and last semester my class of students studied this piece of legislation all semester, and one of the students, Elaine, you'll hear from, is here today to talk about that, but they really enjoyed learning the ins and outs of this bill and doing the analysis, so that was a really fun project for them. Also, there was a social worker, you have the testimony of Valenka, who was a social worker, she is a social worker in Oregon, and she works with foster youth who are aging out of foster care. And she, unfortunately, wasn't able to be here. She wanted to, but you do have her written testimony. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions later.
Thank you. We're going to take the other testimony before we open for questions. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Karis Gilliam and Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Elaine Cherpentier-Philippi, and I'm an undergraduate student of social work and a member of the National Association of Social Workers. I am also a mom to three children. After receiving my bachelor's and master's degrees in social work, I plan on having a career focused on improving the lives of vulnerable children in Oregon. Today, I ask for your support of HJM 12, a bill that would urge our federal lawmakers to convene a White House conference on children. The White House Conference on Children and Youth Act focuses on a myriad of child welfare issues. Included are actions for prevention and intervention in abuse and neglect, and increasing the number of foster children that are successfully and permanently placed through kinship care, adoptions, and reunification. It addresses issues like poverty and substance abuse, health and mental health care access, and the overrepresentation of minority populations served in child and youth systems. Nationally, rates of child abuse and neglect, homelessness, and mental and physical health risks for children and youth are increasing exponentially. The current economic crisis is having a significant impact on the issues that impact our children and youth. It is also widening the margin of families that enter the system. Children and youth represent some of the largest populations of the homeless, the hungry, and the abused. Child abuse is costly on many levels. None of us are immune to it. In our global world, we can no longer look at the issues plaguing our children and youth as someone else's problem. In May of this year, MSNBC.com ran an article reporting that the numbers of children hospitalized for shaken baby syndrome has risen since the onset of the recession. The article was based on research led by University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center and brain injury specialist Dr. Rachel P. Berger. 19-month-old Leonard McIntyre is named as one of the cases in this study. Leonard was reportedly bitten, beaten, and shaken by the mother's boyfriend. After he was taken into custody, the boyfriend admitted punching Leonard and shaking him violently. Leonard's injuries included a broken left arm and ligature marks on his neck. After 5 days on a ventilator, Leonard died. Dr. Berger called our current fiscal and social climate the perfect storm. Increased stress, increased poverty, and yet social services are being cut. Understandably, these cuts are largely the result of dramatic economic and budget reductions faced by many states. Obviously, there are no easy answers. A quote from Lillian Katz says it best. Each of us must come to care about everyone else's children. We must recognize that the welfare of our children is intimately linked to the welfare of all other people's children. After all, when one of our children needs life-saving surgery, someone else's child will perform it. If one of our children is harmed by violence, someone else's child will be responsible for the violent act. The good life for our own children can be secured only if a good life is also secured for all other people's children. The White House Conference on Children would give child welfare advocates and professionals from all over the country the opportunity to review the best practices research pertaining to the prevention of child abuse and neglect and to make recommendations. This conference would help us to shine a spotlight on the needs of vulnerable children. Thank you for hearing HJM 12. Today I urge you to support HJM 12 and the White House Conference on Children and Youth Act.
Thank you so much for coming and presenting your thoughts to us.
Hello, chairs. Let me get this right. Tomei and Gilliam?
Tomei.
Tomei. Pardon me.
That's
and
right.
Respected members of the committee, my name is Sam Jones. I come here on behalf of Oregon Foster Youth Connection, a foster youth advocacy group, and also to represent foster youth. I'm coming here in support of HJM 12. And urging your support because I realize the importance of now and how we can all affect the future. I think that this decision, people in Washington, the White House, will have a great influence on this country with what can be said and done about the welfare system all over the nation. And I'm just telling you that as a foster youth who has experienced 12 years of in and out of homes and that sort of lifestyle, I really know that there's a lot to be said and done, and I think that doing this and allowing this to happen, something like this, a lot of good can come of this. And we mentioned earlier that there's a testimonial of Valenka. She works with ILP, federally funded program, and I know her. I've worked with her before. She's not my case manager, but we relate on a really personal level. And I think a lot of the services and privileges that some foster youth get by going through that program, in addition to life skills taught by those people, are the personal relationships that they develop. And these workers, DHS workers, legislators, everyone gets included in this very sensitive information. This is very, turning point for people's lives. And I just think that the support of this bill will allow people who do give these services to foster youth and the foster youth alone just a better chance at success. So I just urge you and your support for this bill, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Sam. Really appreciate your testimony. Appreciate the good work you're doing. Thank you very much.
So, Chairs Gilliam and Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Pamela Butler. I'm Policy and Outreach Associate for Children First for Oregon, and you have my written testimony coming around now, so I'll be pretty brief. I know you guys are the Human Services Committee. This is preaching to the choir, but I'm basically here to do an overview kind of Child Welfare 101, what's going on in Oregon. So in 2009, which is the latest data we have for the system, there were 11,090 kids who were confirmed as abuse and neglect cases and removed and put into foster care. On any given day, there are over 8,000 kids in foster care. In the whole of 2009, 13,291 kids experienced foster care for at least one day in the year. That's a lot of kids in our community affected by the system. And I would urge your support of HJM 12 and give advocates, child welfare workers, especially youth who've experienced the system, the chance to go to the White House and talk about their experience. The system could do better. It's a shame, a real shame, that the federal government hasn't convened this group for 40 years, was it? And I truly believe that the youth, especially now, there is a national movement for youth coming to the table, and now is a better time than any to engage them at the national level on making child welfare better for all the kids. Some other data is that kids who age out of the system, the most recent studies we have show that by the age of 23 or 24, over half of the former foster youth who aged out in these studies were unemployed. Over 80% of the young men who aged out by the age of 23 had been arrested, and many had been convicted of crimes. The rates of PTSD for kids aging out of long-term foster care are higher than war veterans in U.S. wars. The outlook youth who actually go on to complete a 2 or 4 year degree is less than 6%, and that's a rounding up statistic. So the outcomes for youth leaving foster care, I think you all know, are very dismal. But as you can see from Sam, as you can see from myself and many other members that work in Foster Youth Connection, that giving youth a voice at the table, the local level, and this would help us at the national level, it goes a long way to improving the lives of children in foster care. So I just urge your support of HJN 12, and I look forward to any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Butler. Any questions, any of these witnesses? Thank you so much for coming today and taking the time to present this to us. We really appreciate it. And so we have several people who would like to testify on HJM 13. Pauline, oh boy, my reading today is not good. Delmar Stone, Don Schweitzer, and Deborah already did. So, yeah. And just start talking as soon as you sit down, because we have to be on the floor of the House in just a few minutes. Welcome. And thank you for staying so long.
Well, good morning, co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, and members of the committee. My name is Pauline Javanji, and I am the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Portland State University School of Social Work. I'm also an NASW member and the chair of the Social Work Reinvestment Initiative Task Force for Oregon. And I'm here today to urge your support for Joint Memorial 13, which supports the creation of the Social Work Reinvestment Act, which will support the establishment of a Social Work Reinvestment Commission to advise Congress and the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services on policy issues related to social work. And this piece of legislation will support grants to improve the recruitment and retention of social workers and policy issues related to social work and research related to improving social work. And this act will address the critical need for investment in the social work profession. And you have my written testimony, so I just want to make 3 points very briefly. First of all, as you're aware, social workers work with the most vulnerable in our communities. And as you know, there is a growing population of returning veterans, homeless youth and families, people who are aging and have disabilities, people with mental health difficulties and addictions. All of these are growing populations whose needs are served by social workers in the community. Secondly, people entering social work face tremendous financial challenges. As you know, the cost of higher education is rising tremendously, so the cost of social work education is also rising, and it's rising much faster than the salaries of social workers. So social workers graduating from the MSW program at PSU graduate with a great deal of debt. Tuition for an in-state student is about $13,500 per year for a two-year program, and that doesn't include living costs and costs of books and other materials. The federal student aid is capped at just over $20,000, which means that students are incurring a large amount of debt to complete the program. They have to work while they're going to school, which impacts their capacity to study, and so it becomes very difficult for them. So when they do graduate, they have a great deal of debt, and then, as we know, the salaries of social workers are not equivalent to the salaries of other people with graduate degrees, and so it does put people in a dilemma about whether to proceed with their chosen path of social work, even though they're entering the field or wishing to enter the field because they're motivated to improve the community. As you know, salaries are quite low. We recently did a study of alumni who graduated between 2000 and 2007, and the most frequently mentioned salary range was in the 30s. So this is quite low for people who have both a bachelor's and a graduate degree. Finally, the challenges facing the profession, both financially and in terms of workload demands and safety issues, affect recruitment and retention. And this is particularly an issue for men entering the profession. We particularly are in need of male social workers to work with male clients in corrections and addictions, for example, and with veterans. And over the last decade or more, the maximum number of males in any social work cohort in our graduate school has been 20%. So we believe that men are deterred from entering the field because of low salaries and poor working conditions. Similarly, we're in need of social workers to work in diverse communities, and our capacity to recruit students of color, again, is impacted by these conditions. So I'm here today to ask you for your support for the Social Work Reinvestment Commission legislation, which will review current social work workforce challenges and their effects on communities, develop strategies to enhance social workers' capacity to serve their clients, and provide grants to states to support research in education, training, and excellence in community-based programs. So the end goal is a comprehensive set of strategies and policies which could be moved forward at the state and federal level to address critical social work workforce issues.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we need to move on, so gentlemen.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Delmar Stone, and I am the executive director of the Oregon and Idaho chapters for the National Association of Social Workers. NASW is the professional association for social workers in the United States and also the largest social work organization in the world. NASW strives to be the voice for the full spectrum of this profession, which is very diverse in range and settings and roles. According to the last U.S. Census, there are over 600,000 professional social workers in the nation today, and we estimate that social workers in the U.S. touch about 10 million lives every single day. We appreciate the opportunity this morning to provide remarks on this, the most comprehensive piece of social work legislation ever introduced in the U.S. Congress. When I began my social work career, and particularly since my tenure as executive director of Idaho and Oregon chapters of NASW, I have witnessed, along with my colleagues, an increasing risks to our profession, as well as the ability of social workers to serve their clients. The workforce challenges that we face are enormous, including misperception by the public, insufficient salaries, insurmountable educational debt, and serious safety concerns. There are countless stories of social workers leaving our profession in order to make a decent living, social workers drowning in tens of thousands of debt, and social workers being threatened, assaulted, and even murdered on the job. The Bureau of Labor Statistics states that the employment of social workers is expected to increase much faster than our nation, and we must recruit an additional 100,000 social workers by 2016 in order to keep pace with the demand. Recruitment and retention of social workers must be a focus of the federal government, schools of social work, and employers of social work. Social workers are also leaving our profession due to safety concerns. According to the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, 70% of caseworkers report that frontline staff in their agencies have been victims of violence or have received threats of violence.
I'm going to have to stop you, and I apologize for this, but we need to be on the floor.
Okay.
So could you, it looks like you have your material written there. Could you send that by email? Would be fine if you could send it to our administrator.
Sure.
That would be terrific, and I will make sure that everybody gets your testimony. It sounds like it's
absolutely
very important.
Okay.
And I am an MSW, by the way.
Oh, yes.
So if you could quickly.
Chairs Tomei, Gilliam, members of the committee, our time is brief here. My written testimony you should have there. I just want to point out we did a survey in 2008 of Oregon social workers, and this shows the trend in income to debt ratio that the field has experienced over time. Prior to 1980, they were able to obtain employment wage almost two and a half times that of their student loan debt. Today, the median debt has increased by almost 250%, while wages have declined by 14%, resulting in this inverted ratio of income to debt. I've also, in that same survey, I pulled out some quotes from social workers in the field as they talk about this and the concerns that they have, one of the reasons I am looking at leaving social work is to pay off student loans that I have. I am raising a family now, and the cost of raising a child makes it difficult to pay off loans with a low-paying social work job. So again, I encourage you to support HJM 13. We need some national strategies around this. We need to do something better, because ultimately it's the clients that these social workers are serving that end up paying the cost of this. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for providing written testimony, and we'll look forward to yours, too. Thank you so much. Appreciate you coming today and waiting for so long, also. Yes. Oh, wait. I've got a question here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick housekeeping. Professor, did you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, I did not. My name is Don Schweitzer. I'm an assistant professor and director of field education in the social work program at Pacific University in Forest Grove. Go Boxers.
I'd like to.
They even have a football team.
And have a football. I'd like to ask a quick question. And before I do, this is not your responsibility, Dean. Is it Javinji?
Javinji.
But I have a daughter at PSU. She's a junior. And she calls when she needs money, and I assume everything's okay. But if you see her, just have her check in, because I haven't heard from her for some time.
It is your job.
Yeah, it is. This is different. I'm supportive of both, but this is different from 12. The record is open right now for 12 and 13. On 13, if you could quickly, particularly in your role as executive director, what's our relationship with the Oregon delegation, perhaps the Idaho delegation, on this bill? Where is this bill? It's great to raise our voice, but I'd just like to know where we are with the folks that are closest to this that represent us in Washington.
Chair Gilliam, Chair Tomei, this will be introduced into this Congress March 15th by Congressman Adolphus Towns of New York. And we are meeting with our delegation in April, face to face, and we expect them to be co-sponsors of it.
Follow up, Chair. It might be helpful. I'm not looking for more paper, but it might be helpful to either have the act or a summary of a greater summary. Maybe Jennifer has it already of the act for when we move forward, if we do with the memorial. Just a little more substance as to the act itself. I get the issues, and I appreciate your support. So it's just a suggestion. And I guess the last thing I'd say, Madam Chair, is on HJM 12, I had a suspicion when people were testifying. And I'm just going to say Elaine, because Elaine, I can't remember your last name right now, that your three children might have been in the room. And I see that it's likely that they are. Anyway, I wanted to welcome them and tell you how proud you should be of your mother, because this is very different. You know, we have a job to do at the state level, and then they have a job to do back in Washington. So this is particularly complicated, but bravo to your mom for urging us to urge our Congress to take a look at this very important field, which she's obviously dedicated her life. So you're welcome, and be nice to your mom.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Any other questions or statements, concerns? Thank you so much. And with that, we'll close the... Yes. Did I hear somebody?
No.
I'll close the hearings on House Joint Memorial 12 and House Joint Memorial 13. Colleagues, earlier we had gotten a memo that our meetings would be starting at 8, but I did talk with the co-speaker, and he said it was fine if it was okay with the committee if we meet at 8:30. As long as the floor sessions are at 10:30. So if that's okay with everybody, when they go to 10, then we'll be meeting at 8. Oh, I feel the same way, Representative.
So Monday and Wednesday, or just Wednesdays at 8:30?
I think Monday is, as far as I know. But we'll send out memos, and
10,
she'll put them in big, bold letters so we all know when we're meeting. But as far as I know, it's... floor session is at 10:30 and our meeting will be at 8:30. Any questions about that? Any concerns? All right. Thank you all. And we do have a meeting, I told you, on
Friday the 11th.
Friday the 11th, we will have an informational hearing
Correct, on the reunification process.
Like North and South Korea?
Yeah.
No, with regard to having DHS folks, as well as the Commission on Children's and Families, someone from the District Attorney's Office to talk about that, the adoption foster care process and the reunification. It was raised when we had the issue was raised by Representative Widener specifically had some questions relative to that process when we had the informational with DHS talking about their overall programs within their department. So it's a follow-up to that initial hearing.
Representative Widener.
I wonder, we're going to do it here in the committee. I'd almost like to have it more as a work group just to kind of see where things are at so we can dig in a little better and get...
We can't do that if we have a quorum.
All of them.
Yeah.
Well, we could fire, you know, half the members so we don't have a quorum. Go in two shifts.
I think it's important information for us to have. But we can...
Sometimes
we can,
it's tougher to do in this setting than when you're sitting at a table across.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I don't disagree.
Asking them, okay, let's be honest here, and because things get hid sometimes in this situation.
Yeah. And you're certainly welcome to meet privately. With, you know, bring a couple of other people with you to meet with these folks. I know they'd be happy to meet with you. Okay, and then we'll be arranging another work session that was brought up today about the issues, Representative Greenlick, and who else? Somebody else was talking about. Looking at how all of these issues fit in with the Ways and Means and what kind of policy we want to send from the Policy Committee, what message we want to send to Ways and Means. And Representative Greenlick is our representative there on Ways and Means.
I know co-chair Freeman and Kotek are anxious to get some policy guidance on this
area. Good. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you. And children?
What is it?
Jeez. Okay, with that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services.